Picard gestured to the animal-headed men on the dune. Immediately, the incarnates fanned out and moved with enviable speed and agility across the dunes toward the entrance of the redoubt to take up positions on either side of the open door.
I don't think it's any of our people. It could be a group of magistrates coming from one of the vills.
I doubt that. There hasn't been any activity around here since... We're not expecting anybody.
Anybody else, you mean? It's pretty obvious you were expecting us.
The car didn't deny the assertion, and Kane dropped the subject. He stared into the darkness beyond the threshold of the entrance.
We shouldn't take any chances.
Grant tapped DeFore on the shoulder and gestured to the dune where Descartes and the Incarnates had first appeared.
Reba, get behind that. If the shit hits the fan, you should be safe from any stray fire.
Her mouth a grim line, the medic nodded and half ran, half stumbled across the sifting sands and disappeared behind a dune. Grant watched her go.
What about you?
Your territory, your show.
For a few seconds, Descartes looked uncomfortable. Then he spun on his heel and ran to join the Incarnates, who had positioned themselves strategically around the entrance to the redoubt. Both Kane and Grant joined DeFore behind the base of the dune. An eternity seemed to pass before there was a hint of activity inside the doorway. Then a single figure, enshrouded by a beige-hooded cloak, stepped with a strange grace over the threshold and stood in the sand. It carried a long spear, almost half again the size of the person carrying it. The figure stooped over slightly as it inspected the ground, then walked forward another few yards, stepping in such a way as to suggest an unusual foot structure.
Like they're walking on tiptoes.
Or the sand is burning their feet.
As the words left his mouth, the second figure joined the first, dressed identically, but with a rifle of an unusual design strapped across its back. It looked heavy and clumsy, larger even than the Barrett sniper rifle Grant favored.
Ever see a rifle like that before?
No, not ever. Not even Pix.
The two figures bent their hooded heads toward each other and seemed to be exchanging words.
At least they're not mags.
The words caught in his throat as the first of the figures stood tall and threw off the robe. There was no mistaking the feminine curves, with the tawny mane of dark golden hair rippling down her back and full, firm breasts. But the resemblance to a human woman ended there. Her legs were disproportionately long and slender, but her feet were very large and had only four clawed toes. Her head was round, with a flat face tapering to a narrow chin. The big, slanted eyes gleamed scarlet in the iris. The wide mouth showed sharp teeth with filament-like whiskers quivering slightly in the breeze. Her big ears rose to sharp points on either side of her skull. Sleek, black-striped tan fur covered her body. It lightened into a rich shade of creamy white at her throat.
What the fuck is that? And where did it... she come from?
At the moment, I'm more interested in what she's doing here.
Bridget Baptiste inspected the Mercator map distractedly.
How long have they been gone?
She stood in the central control complex of Cerberus. A long room with high vaulted ceilings, it was lined by consoles of dials, switches, and computer stations. The huge Mercator relief map of the world spanned one wall. Pinpoints of light glowed in almost every country, and thin phosphorescent lines networked across the continents, like a web spun by a rad-mad spider. The map delineated all the locations of all functioning indexed gateway units all over the world.
Less than 2 hours. Well within reasonable time parameters. I thought you were preoccupied with retooling the interphaser.
Bridget turned to face him, a slightly abashed smile on her face.
I turned it over to Brewster for a little while.
Having second thoughts about sitting out this mission?
Only Domi, Lakesh, and Quavel were present in the redoubt's nerve center. Bridget guessed Lakesh had volunteered to sit in for Bry while he took a meal break. In the wake of the recent assault on the redoubt, the man had actually earned a long vacation, working as he had almost non-stop to restore the operational functions of the installation. The major repairs had only recently been completed, although a few of the subsystems were yet to be tested and debugged.
It's only a recon, or supposed to be.
They're fine!
Bridget turned toward the albino girl. Domi was dressed far less formally than anyone else in the command center, or the entire redoubt for that matter. She wore very high-cut khaki shorts, a white tank top, and nothing else. She almost never wore shoes while in the redoubt, and not very often while outside of it either, since her feet were calloused on the soles. Born a feral child of the outlands, Domi was barely 5 feet tall and weighed every ounce of 100 pounds. Her unruly bone-white hair was cropped close to her head, and her bright red eyes shone like polished rubies on either side of her thin-bridged nose. Her forehead still showed a purple discoloration, a memento of McCann's infrasound gauntlet. On the screen, she saw an aerial topographical map of the state of California. Superimposed over it flashed three icons. The telemetry transmitted from Kane, Grant, and DeFore's subdermal biolink transponders scrolled in a drop-down window across the top of the screen. The computer systems recorded every byte of data sent to the ComSat and directed it down to the redoubt's hidden antenna array. Sophisticated scanning filters combed through the telemetric signals using special human biological encoding. The digital data stream was then routed to another console through the locational program to precisely isolate the team's present position in time and space. The program considered and discarded thousands of possibilities within milliseconds. All of the icons, including Kane's, glowed green, much to Bridget's relief. Images spun in the depths of the monitor, memories from even further back than her first meeting with Kane. For a shaved splinter of a second, she saw him as a young man of 19 or 20, sword in his hand, as he charged to rescue her from the Norman soldiers who held her captive. Kane had worn another name then, another form, but the name that had been chosen for him by Morrigan, the blind nun from Ireland's Priory of Awen, fit him best, Anamkara. In the Gaelic tongue, it meant soul friend. The dreams both of them had experienced during different Metrans jumps and crisis points suggested that they'd lived past lives, each continually intertwined with the other in some manner, never knowing true love. She ran her fingers through her hair and tried hard not to think about the message conveyed from the future Kane of 27 years hence regarding their relationship. She was glad she and Kane hadn't discussed the issue at length. For all his fighting prowess, or maybe because of it, Bridget wasn't sure, Kane thought first with his emotions. That was alien to everything Bridget Baptiste held dear. To survive, one needed a clear head. She worked hard to keep hers that way.
I hope they find something of use there.
Even if they don't, just knowing there's nothing there is useful, right?
That's a very zen observation, darlingest one.
The albino girl slid an arm around Lakesh's waist and pressed her head against his shoulder. Lakesh smiled down at her fondly and gently stroked her bone-white hair. Bridget studiously avoided paying too much attention to the open display of affection. She wasn't sure if she hadn't preferred it when those two kept their intimacy a secret. From a computer station, Quivel spoke up.
This is interesting.
Almost gratefully, Bridget turned toward her.
What is? The information I found in the database relating to the Mission Invictus Redoubt and Dr. O'Brien.
I thought we went over that at the briefing.
Superficially, I suppose we did. But I did a little more research into her and the various branches of Overproject Excalibur.
What did you uncover?
As I'm sure you're aware, a great deal of the Overproject Excalibur research was directed toward the creation of the hybrid race. Although for some reason, much of the engineering regarding advanced psionic ability was omitted during the final phase of our creation, I find that to be somewhat disconcerting.
How so?
Apparently, such abilities were actually desirable during the initial Mission Invictus experiments, but were not actively pursued afterward. But it's obvious much of the research conducted there before the nuclear war served as the template for my kind. Not to mention all the other genetically engineered life forms that grew from Overproject Excalibur subdivisions.
Wouldn't that make you related to some of the sticky, scalies, and other muties, then?
That is true. But unlike those creatures, who were designed to be soldiers, my kind were bred to lead, not fight or follow.
Where are you going with this, Quivel?
Excuse me for a moment, please.
Lakesh disengaged himself from Domi and returned to the Master Ops station. Touching a key on the board, he narrowed his eyes at the data appearing on the monitor screen.
I've got a signal on a gateway activation.
All eyes in the chamber turned to look at the Mercator map spanning the wall. All the lights glowed a steady yellow.
It's not registering on the index. That means it's not part of the official Cerberus network, but one of the modular units.
I'll trace the jump line. One moment.
Lakesh bent over the keyboard, his fingers a blur of motion. He returned his attention to the map.
Got it.
On the Mercator map, a light appeared in the African subcontinent. Lakesh took a cursory glance at the machine language scrolling across the monitor screen.
From the coordinates, the jump line originates from Egypt, from the vicinity of the Sphinx in Giza.
Egypt?
Brigid stared at the brightly glowing pinpoint of light on the map. Then the tiny bulb went dark.
That was exciting.
Lakesh, did the bulb burn out or what?
Lakesh rubbed his chin thoughtfully, looked at the data on the screen again, and then shrugged.
It's possible that it was merely a computer glitch. One of the subroutines not operating properly yet. Friend Bry hasn't run a diagnostic on everything yet.
I don't think it's a coincidence. Giza in Egypt, Aten in the Barren Range.
No, that doesn't seem to be likely, does it?
Is it possible there's a map trans in the vicinity of the Sphinx?
Not only possible, but very probable, now that I think about it. Before the nuke cost, a much-debated chamber beneath the Sphinx was finally located and entered. The discoveries were immediately given the highest secret classification. A research station had been set up nearby under the guise of an archaeological dig. A modular gateway was installed in the chamber.
Did you ever learn anything about the findings there?
Not much, I'm afraid.
Enlighten us with what is known, if you would, please.
As you may know, there are many pyramids and monuments built up and down the Nile River in Egypt. They were considered to be places of ascent, the point of departure for the deceased on his journey to the heavens to join the gods.
What's that got to do with what's under the Sphinx?
I'll get to that. The pyramid monuments were preceded by brick tombs called mastabas. They contained burial and special chambers set up so that the loved ones of the deceased could offer food and other goods that could be used by the individual in the afterlife. This style was changing during the Third Dynasty, when Imhotep placed a series of stone mastabas on top of one another in a graduated design, which formed the step pyramid at Saqqara. This pyramid was built to house Djoser, who ruled the country from 2630 to 2611 BC. This first pyramid was 204 feet in height and comprised of six separate layers, or steps if you will, each one smaller in size. The base of the pyramid was 358 feet by 411 feet. The layers were covered with limestone and were surrounded by a complex of buildings, replicas of those erected to celebrate said festivals. The entire structure and its surroundings measured 1,800 feet by 900 feet in total, and the roads were paved in limestone.
The ancient Egyptians didn't do things in half measures, did they?
You might say that. It was quite amazing, actually. The entire site was itself a miniature city with its own priests. The items found in the tomb were equally amazing.
Such as?
I'm getting to that. Other step pyramids were started soon after Djoser's rule, but the true pyramids didn't appear until the Fourth Dynasty, during the reign of Snofru from 2575 to 2551 BC. Snofru ordered the construction of two pyramids at Ashur and finished his father's pyramid at Meidum. It was from these monuments that the traditional pyramidal complex evolved. The Great Pyramids at Giza are the best known of them all.
How many were built?
There were 70 other such monuments erected, stretching the length of the Nile as far south as the Sudan, but few of them were as large or as grand as the ones located at Giza. The so-called Great Pyramid of Khufu covered 13 acres.
What was the point of building these things? Just as mausoleums?
Not exactly. There were astronomical and religious traditions involved, too.
Those aspects were only the proverbial tip of the iceberg. Because of the sheer size of the pyramids and their strategic positioning, many scholars thought they served as beacons.
For who?
Why, the Anunnaki, I would imagine.
We already have a little evidence that Enlil was believed to be the god Set by the ancient Egyptians. So it's possible the Anunnaki hid something beneath the Sphinx.
I'd say so. Khafre, who ruled from 2520 to 2494 BC, constructed the great monument at Giza. It remained untouched for over 1,000 years, until Thutmosis IV of the 18th dynasty had it repaired. Thutmosis, who had been a prince at the time he first laid eyes on the great monument, had a dream in which the Sphinx appeared to him and complained rather vehemently about its deteriorating condition, and told him that he would become the pharaoh when he had restored the statue to its former glory.
The statue came to him while he was sleeping and talked to him?
Lakesh merely smiled at the young woman, but didn't answer. She suddenly stopped laughing and turned solemn.
What was found?
Why, do you...
All of them turned toward the map, just as the light began to glow.
What's going on now?
Lakesh sat down at the console and began inputting commands into the keyboard.
This is no glitch, I'm afraid. We've got a jump in progress, definitely from Egypt. I've got a trace on the transit line.
Well, don't keep us in suspense.
Lakesh lifted his eyes and met Bridget's unblinkingly.
The Guadalupe Redoubt. That's the destination lock.
The Catwoman drove the butt of her spear into the soft sand and dropped to all fours, sniffing at the ground before her.
She looks like a panther. Never even heard of a muti like that. Or a hybrid.
Although Kane didn't reply, he agreed with his friend's comment. The woman definitely was a hybrid blending of human and feline. He found himself entranced by her beauty. There was a beast's blaze in her eyes, but something startlingly innocent there, too. The woman stopped sniffing and stood, facing the dune behind which Grant and Kane were hidden. Her lips curled in an unmistakable snarl, revealing her mouthful of needle-tipped teeth. Her cloaked companion unlimbered the strange-looking rifle, swiftly raising it to a shoulder. Simultaneously, the incarnates rose from the top of the dune. They held the V-pronged rods before them, aiming the weapons at the two newcomers. Snarling, the feline female bounded backward into the doorway of the redoubt, tearing her spear from the ground in the process. Her robed companion backpedaled rapidly and began to scream. For a second, Kane glimpsed a face more falcon than human, beaked and feathered, with eyes like beads of onyx swimming in little pools of molten silver. Leaping to his feet, Descartes rushed down the face of the dune, his Sin-Eater firing a full-auto fusillade. The 9mm jacketed bullets pounded a sand-spurting line toward the falcon face. Screeching a high-pitched howl that had a faint echo of lost humanity in it, the Catwoman hefted her spear and cast it in a swift, looping overarm throw. The bronze point crashed into Descartes' chest. Although the molded polycarbonate was designed to withstand even heavy-caliber rounds, the impact of the spear was still sufficient to knock him off his feet. The incarnate split up into three groups of four. The first group maintained its position atop the dune, kneeling in the burning sand, weapons pointed at the redoubt. The second group sprinted across the ridgeline, intending to approach from the rear of the installation. The other group charged from the opposite direction. All of the helmeted men moved with uncanny grace and speed over the heavy sand, and Kane had to grudgingly admire the skill they displayed. The desert was their territory, and they knew it well. The falcon-faced figure triggered the rifle. A thunderous boom shattered the still desert air, and a bull-helmeted incarnate atop the dune flailed backward. The helmet provided no protection whatsoever. Apparently unmoved by the sudden death of their companion, the surviving incarnates extended their weapons. Flares of energy, almost invisible in the sunlight, burst all around the redoubt's entrance. The Catwoman was struck several times from different angles. Little halos of energy danced up and down her body, causing the fur to stand on end. She fell face first to the ground just outside the doorway. She writhed briefly, then moved no more. Energy flashed along the barrel of the Falcon Face's rifle, and he recoiled, dropping the weapon. Outnumbered and outgunned, the hooded and cloaked figure spun on a heel, disappearing into the redoubt. All of the incarnates broke from their positions and raced down the dunes and across the sand toward the entrance. The unmistakable sound of heavy gears grinding reached Kane's and Grant's ears as the huge multi-ton door of the redoubt began to fall. Several of the incarnates reached the entrance and dropped to their bellies. They raised their silvery rods and fired beneath the rapidly descending door. It sealed with a booming thud. The helmeted men got to their feet and clustered around the keypad controls of the sector. Kane and Grant rose and walked down toward the redoubt. While Grant helped a groaning and cursing Descartes to his feet, Kane continued toward the body of the fallen Catwoman. Kneeling, he placed a finger on the side of her neck, absently noting the softness of her fur as he felt for a pulse. He stood, shaking his head as DeFore approached him.
Dead?
As a mackerel.
Kane stepped over the threshold and picked up the rifle the Falcon Face had carried. He gauged its weight as more than 30 pounds. Opening the breech, he ejected a shell, catching it deftly in his hand. As Grant walked up, he tossed it to him.
Looks like a 50 caliber. What do you think?
For sure. Depleted uranium core round. It'll punch through the skin of a sandcat like it was made of paper.
He hefted it, grimacing a little at the weight.
Not exactly made for foot soldiers.
Descartes, wincing at the pain in his chest, joined them.
One for one. Not exactly the kind of trade-off I like. Nephron won't like it either. Apis was one of her favorites. I've been pushing her to allow me to get the Incarnates to start wearing helmets made of metal instead of wood. If she would have listened to me, things might have turned out differently.
Not against uranium rounds. Not even your own armor would have saved you.
Defoe knelt beside the Felinoid, turning her head back and forth. The expression of animalistic ferocity on her face was almost demonic due to the crimson glint in her glazed eyes.
I don't see any wounds. What kind of weapons did your incarnates use on her?
They're called metal rods. I'm not sure exactly how they work, but they operate on an ancient principle about channeling Sekhem, the life force. It takes years of training to use them.
And what about Miss Kitty here? I get the distinct feeling this isn't the first time you've come up against her, or creatures like her.
An incarnate wearing a headpiece resembling the likeness of a crocodile stomped angrily up to Descartes.
I don't know how he did it, but the damn Herusian somehow managed to lock up the codes. We can't get in.
Herusian?
Maybe we can rewire the controls.
I don't know how to do that. Do either of you?
I'll crack it, but I want some answers afterward.
Reaching into the pouch, Kane removed a small, flat device shaped like an elongated circle with a slit down the middle. He attached the device to the keypad, touched a tiny stud projecting from the center of it, and watched.
I wish I hadn't left my sign back in Dalsa. Would have come in handy several times since I left.
Grant nodded, but didn't reply. The Nema sign, or sign, as it was more commonly known, was essentially an electronic lockpick. Given time, it would eventually crack any locking code, encryption, or security-protected device. It allowed access, be it to a lock, or even in some cases, computer programs. The device rarely failed to work, except when deliberate countermeasures were installed. There was a sudden loud pop, and a flurry of sparks erupted from the lock. Kane ripped the device off almost instantly, but the damage had been done. He examined it briefly, then tossed the now useless device into the sand.
Power surge. Fried the sign.
I thought they were built to withstand something like that. What could have caused it?
Tilting his head to the right, Grant looked at the young man.
Could have been anything. The lock might have been booby-trapped, or Hawkface could have shorted out the circuits on the other side.
Kane scratched idly at his chin with his hand, staring at the damaged keypad, and then he glanced over at Grant.
Be a fairly long hike back home.
Yeah, that's a safe bet. From California to Montana, I doubt we'd make it by supper.
Descartes, do you think you might be able to get the spare parts we need to fix this in Aten, or possibly transport?
The young man pondered the question. Very slowly, he nodded.
Yeah, I think we can work something out one way or the other.
We need to get word back to Bridget and the others before too much time passes. I don't want them jumping in blind, especially if there might be hostiles waiting inside.
Yeah, but how? Without the satellite uplink we have in the Sandcats, we're pretty much cut off.
We have a sophisticated comm system in the city, so again, maybe we can work something out.
We're working lots of things out today. How very convenient for you.
I gave you my word. You can trust me. And I don't break my word.
I guess we'll have to find that out for ourselves. Let's get going. The sooner we arrive in Aten, the sooner we can figure out a way out of this mess.
Descartes' eyes moved back and forth between Kane and Grant, and he shrugged.
Follow me, then. Let's take the Bastion with us. Queen Nephron will want to see her.
The Incarnate heaved the cat-like corpse up over his broad shoulder. All of the Incarnates followed Descartes past the dunes. Kane, Defoe, and Grant fell into step behind them. Two of the animal-helmeted men carried the body of Apis, their fallen comrade. Blood dripped from his bullet-blasted skull, spattering the desert with an artless pattern.
I hope this place isn't far, because we've still got several hours of pretty hot daylight left.
It's about 30 miles away.
30? Even by a forced all-night march, we won't get there until sometime tomorrow, if we're lucky.
You don't seriously think all of us hoofed it through the damn desert dressed like this, do you? We would have dropped dead inside of 3 miles.
We thought you were just too stubborn.
As they rounded the dune, Descartes gestured theatrically to 10 big-wheeled carts that reminded Kane of nothing so much as chariots, minus horses or any other means of locomotion. Grant eyed the two-wheeled vehicles skeptically.
That's how you get around in the Barrens?
They're not very fast, but they get you there in the end.
Kane and Grant walked around the chariots, both men silently admiring the design, which was functional and elegant in its simplicity. Descartes pointed to a stacked array of concave mirrored squares within an open box at the rear of the chassis.
Semiconductor chips converting solar energy into electricity. They make enough power to run the chariots for miles, as long as you don't drive them too long at night.
Or on a cloudy day.
A ram-headed incarnate jumped in next to Kane.
Let's get moving. We might make it back before the evening meal.
Hold on a second, Descartes. If we don't gate back to our home base soon, and if our people don't hear from us within a couple of hours, somebody will come looking for us.
Yeah. Assuming they can get the redoubt door open, it would be a nice gesture if you could leave one of your men here to tell them what's going on and escort them to Aten if necessary.
The young man considered Kane's suggestion for a handful of seconds, then nodded. He gestured toward an incarnate who wore a helmet resembling a narrow-snouted dog's head.
Anubis, you don't mind staying here for the night, do you?
The canine head turned toward him, then shook from side to side.
I guess not. I've got field rations and water.
That's mighty accommodating.
He's my brother-in-law.
Brother? You're married?
Descartes' smile widened into a prideful grin.
Into the royal family, no less. But don't feel you have to show me any special courtesy.
Don't worry, we won't.
Kane climbed into a chariot with Descartes, sitting at the edge of the platform beside the solar cell battery. The young man engaged the drive with a purring hum, and the vehicle moved smoothly forward. Grant, sharing a chariot with the crocodile-helmeted man and the corpse of the catwoman, caught Kane's eye.
Just a scout out. When will I learn not to listen to you?
Lakesh kept glancing from the monitor screen to the Mercator map. His fingers flew across the keyboard, and he studied the copy glowing on the screen.
Oh, it's not a glitch in the sensor web. It definitely registered a MAT and DMAT cycle. Someone, or something, gated into the redoubt from Egypt, and a few minutes later gated back out to the same place.
Domi piped up from the biolink terminal.
Whatever made their vital signs spike must be over. They've gone back to normal.
They would have jumped back here by now if they were able. We still receive an active read on the Guadalupe Gateway unit. Something very strange is going on there.
What are you thinking of doing, then?
I'm thinking that we should make a reconnaissance to the redoubt. They might need our help.
Reluctantly, Bridget found herself agreeing with Lakesh.
When do you want to go?
Lakesh stood up quickly. A flicker of pain crossed his features as he felt a stabbing sensation in his right knee joint.
As soon as possible, while there is still daylight. Darlingest one, do you wish to accompany us?
You have to ask?
Lakesh returned her grin.
I'll go to the armory and pick out a weapon that would be suited to my skills.
Bridget's eyes narrowed in surprise. Even though Lakesh had gone on away missions before, he never carried a gun, usually passing the responsibility for packing the musketry, as he called it, to Kane and Grant.
Don't look so astounded. I promise I won't get in the way.
I never thought you would. Let's meet back here in 10.
Even though Lakesh was primarily responsible for moving most of the equipment into the redoubt over a period of many years, he was still staggered at the sheer magnitude of weapons of destruction that were housed in the Cerberus armory. He walked past the stands, between the rows of rifles, handguns, crates of explosives, and mountains of ammunition. He stopped and looked at a rack containing several dozen Kar 15 carbines, which looked like smaller versions of the standard M16A2 assault rifles used by the American military right up to the Skydark. Pulling one of the weapons off the rack, he examined it swiftly. The firearm felt strange in his hands, even though he had spent many an hour on the outdoor firing range, honing his skills until he was a passable marksman. He pulled back the cocking mechanism, feeling it move smoothly and easily in his grip. Lakesh picked up a magazine and placed it in the weapon, letting the weapon's cocking mechanism click back in place, pushing a single round into the chamber. He slung the weapon and took a bandolier from the rack, then spent several minutes fitting 6 fully loaded magazines into it. Once finished, he headed deeper into the armory and went to a display case holding a number of handguns. One of the weapons he had practiced with was the old standby Colt 45. The ammunition for the pistol was plentiful, and the weapon was reliable. He selected one from the case, as well as 4 fully loaded magazines and a hip holster for it. Satisfied with his weapons of choice, he made his way to the back of the armory and took a Kevlar weave jacket from a rack. How things have changed, he reflected sourly. A little less than a year before, he had been an old man who could barely walk 100 feet without pausing to catch his breath. Ever since that fateful day when Sam had restored his youth and vitality by the introduction of cell repair nanites into his body, he had felt he was living in a dream world. Now, the dream was inexorably entering the realm of nightmare. The results of a recent medical examination had shown that the nanites in his body were now inert. They no longer worked to maintain his metabolism at its restored levels. If Sam had exerted control over them, he had either relinquished it on his own accord as a way to punish him, or the influence was broken for another reason. Regardless of the reasons, DeFore's prognosis was that he would begin to age, but at an accelerated rate. He had no choice but to agree with her gloomy diagnosis. The worst-case scenario she offered had him back in his pre-restoration physical condition inside of a year. The absolutely best-case situation would be one where he simply began to age normally from the point the nanites stopped working, but he knew that was an unrealistic hope at best. Without the help of Sam's nanomachines, his body simply couldn't maintain its present state. In fact, the possibility existed that his cardiovascular system wouldn't be able to withstand the strain of rapid aging and would shut down. He had kept the prognosis to himself so far, although he knew eventually he would have to apprise Domi of it. But he was fairly certain that the girl's razor-keen perceptions had already noted his gray hairs and how he grimaced at the return of old aches and pains. Lakesh didn't want to return to his former decrepit condition, but the only way to retain his youth was to cut a deal with Sam, and that meant betraying Cain, Brigid, and the other Cerberus exiles. He had suffered through many a sleepless night, debating all the ramifications of joining forces with Sam once and for all. He always came up with a good reason to remain loyal to his friends, people he now felt to be his family, despite the problems among them that had occurred over the years. Despite the frequent disagreements and arguments, they always looked out for one another and genuinely cared for each other's well-being. In some ways, the ties between and among the exiles of the Cerberus Redoubt were stronger than that of blood kin. As far as Lakesh was concerned, the three people in the Guadalupe Redoubt were his best friends, his colleagues, even his children, and he was going to bring them back home, no matter what the risk might be. It was the kind of sunset seen only in the Outlands. The sky looked like a lowering curtain of blues and purples, smeared with lurid flame-red streaks and molten brass. All around was basically flatland, without even the first sproutings of desert scrub to relieve the monotony of the terrain. Deckard braked the chariot to a halt and gestured to the rolling dunes, waving from left to right.
There we are, the Kingdom City of Aten.
Cain stared out over the desolation, wondering if the young man had gone mad from exposure to the heat.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's nothing there.
That's because it's hidden.
Cain continued to scan the windswept wastes, searching for anything that might indicate the location of a city or even an outhouse.
You're sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. I live there, remember? Come on, let's get out of this heat and have something to eat. This arm is really starting to chafe my ass.
With that, the young magistrate engaged the drive of the chariot and guided it toward the crest of a small dune. The incarnates followed him in their own chariots, and Cain and Grant exchanged questioning looks but didn't say anything. For the third time over the past 20 minutes, Cain squashed the desire to boot Deckard out of the chariot. During the 2-hour ride from the redoubt, the youth had steadfastly refused to answer any of Cain's questions, deflecting them with either smiles or headshakes. Cain's instincts told him that a number of events were swirling around the Barrens, and the Redoubt and Aten were focal points. He knew he and his friends had been expected in the Redoubt, and he was almost as certain that the arrival of the Catwoman and her hawk-faced companion hadn't come as a complete surprise to Deckard either. Regardless, he didn't feel as if he and his friends were being led into a trap. At least, he could only hope not. When the chariots crested the dune, the terrain changed slightly. Cain couldn't quite put his finger on it, and then a moment later he realized that it appeared as if the desert itself were actually moving. The sand seemed to be shifting, rippling from a faint breeze.
A mirage?
Thermal inversion, maybe.
Deckard just smiled, turning the chariot slightly to the right. Then Kane realized the desert wasn't actually flowing before the wind, but huge sand-colored nets moved with the breeze. They stretched out over the land and were staked down in place by a network of large, sturdy poles.
I'll be damned. No wonder they've kept themselves hidden for so long. Unless a Deathbird crew knew exactly where to look, they couldn't spot this from the air.
The netting covered large plots of land in which all manner of crops grew. As the chariots rolled past, they identified wheat, barley, tomatoes, corn, and many other vegetables growing out of rich, dark soil. Irrigation canals twisted through the fields, carrying water to the crops. Dozens of men and women, all naked except for a simple white kilt wrapped around their waists, toiled in the hidden fields.
Haven't you seen a farm before?
Not like this, I haven't.
Descartes grinned.
If this impresses you, wait till you see the city it feeds.
As the chariots rolled past the men and women, the workers stopped and stared at the newcomers with mild curiosity. Kane studied each face they passed, searching for any sign of hostility or fear. Several of the men nodded courteously to him, and even one of the women smiled saucily, flaunting her toned body. After almost 5 minutes of rolling through the tarp-covered fields, the ground slowly declined into a shallow coulee that Kane guessed to be a dry stream bed. It pitched sharply downward the farther they traveled along it. The channel stretched between two bastions of rock. On either side of the outcropping stood four burly men. They wore gold-trimmed kilts and odd headpieces made of striped cloth, and all were armed with military-issue Stoner M207 auto rifles. Grinning, Descartes braked the chariot to a halt and disembarked. He clasped one of the men by the forearm and spoke briefly to him. The man smiled and nodded to the other three guards, who stepped aside and left the stream bed clear for them to navigate. Descartes gestured, and everyone climbed from the chariots.
We walk from here on out.
Who is that? Another brother-in-law?
Nothing of the kind. An uncle-in-law.
These people here don't seem to be afraid of us.
Why should they be?
Descartes led Kane's group as he entered the cavern. The scorching heat of the desert faded as a cool breeze played over their faces. On it, Kane detected the aromas of cooking fires, food, spices, and other pleasant smells, mixed liberally with the unmistakable smell of human sweat. But his nose didn't catch a whiff of decay or excrement that was always prominent in the Tartarus pits or in the Outlandervilles. The long stream bed wound through a tunnel beneath the desert hardpan, the channel cut by a long-ago subterranean waterway. Bronze lamps hanging from hooks driven into the stone provided a steady, flickering illumination. By the time they had traveled half a mile, they had taken no less than a dozen sharp turns. At each turn stood a pair of guards, some armed with assault rifles. None of them made any move to stop them or appeared hostile in any way. When the group rounded another corner, they reached a T-intersection, and the incarnates marched down the left-hand passageway. Descartes led Kane, Defore, and Grant along the right tunnel. It widened significantly. The young man stopped on a long, wide ledge and gestured for the three outlanders to look out over the city of Aten. Below them, spread out over a broad canyon, was a bustling settlement. But it was more than either a settlement or even a city. It came very near to meeting Kane's definition of a metropolis. Scattered almost as far as he could see, up and down the valley floor were mud, brick, and clay huts, all of them expertly crafted, many covered with hieroglyphs. Everywhere they looked, they saw men and women engaged in day-to-day chores, cleaning clothing, preparing meals. They saw small shops of every sort, stalls selling meats and vegetables, artisans plying their skills. The impression of the city was essentially one of compactness. Situated in the center of the city, a huge, sculpted structure made of a dark, dully gleaming material rose from the valley floor. In height and breadth, it was not even close to the monstrous proportions reached by the D&M Pyramid of Mars, or even the ziggurat they had seen in Amazonia. But for a hidden valley in California, it was an impressive sight. All three Outlanders had seen pics of the Sphinx on the Giza Plains of Egypt, and the giant statue bore a superficially similar outline, that of a human-headed lion in repose, with both forelegs outstretched. But it was completely black, apparently wrought from a single gargantuan stone by an art that surpassed mere craft. The outer edges of the black sphinx were cut cleanly and sharply, and the head rising from the beast's body was meant to depict the epitome of male beauty. A square-cut headdress framed a sculpted face that evinced strength, nobility, pride, and a touch of arrogance. The eyes were the most unsettling feature of the face. They were represented by red gems or blood-colored glass, making the giant effigy appear even more fearsome. Kane surveyed the statue with a critical eye and estimated the Sphinx was close to 200 feet long, measuring from the extended forepaws to the hindquarters, which flowed into a valley wall. The top of the human head towered a minimum of 75 feet above the canyon floor.
Holy shit.
I know. I had the same reaction a year ago when I first stood on this ledge and looked down at the city.
Grant glanced up at the sheer walls of the valley rising at least 200 feet on either side of the city and made a soft sound of surprise. Kane followed his gaze and noticed the skies above were not clear, but the air still had a clarity about it. Then he realized a huge swatch of beige mesh was stretched over the entire declivity. It filtered the light of the sunset, but without impairing illumination. Evidently, the mesh had been anchored to the valley walls to obscure what lay below from aerial observation.
Even with these precautions, I can't understand how this place stayed hidden for as long as it has. This many people, the crops that you have to grow, there are just too many things to give your presence away to the Barrens years ago.
We've managed to stay out of the Barrens' eyes. You can't argue that. Well, at least until recently.
What do you mean?
Later. If the Queen wants you to know what I mean, she'll tell you.
Take us to her, then.
We can find out if she'll see you. She might still be in audience with an emissary that arrived yesterday. I can't promise anything.
Emissary? From where? I thought your kingdom was secret.
Descartes started walking along the ledge without responding. He strode down a ramp that slanted steeply into the Valley of Aten. Despite Kane's anxiety, his eyes scarcely left the magnificent view spread out before him and his friends. The skill displayed in the architecture was even more impressive up close. Each building was constructed of dried bricks, painstakingly fit to perfection, and many were covered in a thin dirt coating so smooth that not even the slightest irregularity could be seen. Colorful hieroglyphs decorated the facades of many of the structures, most showing idyllic scenes of day-to-day life, while others denoted what trade was plied or wares sold in a particular building. As with the farmers above ground, the people they passed showed no signs of fear or hostility. A few of the citizens regarded them with curious glances, and others bowed their heads as they passed by.
This is starting to creep me out.
Yeah, it doesn't seem right. The people are way too friendly if they've lived in isolation for 100 years or more.
What is it with you two? Are you only happy when someone is trying to kill you?
I wouldn't say happy.
It's just what we're used to.
I know what you mean.
Kane noticed they had picked up a group of followers, a group of semi-naked children. They followed at a discreet distance, whispering and giggling among themselves. Kane found himself missing Brigid. He knew that she would enjoy the city, and her incredible memory and historical insights could prove invaluable. Pausing, he turned around to face the gaggle of children. It would have been difficult to ascertain the sex of the youngest children if it weren't for the fact that they were naked. They all had shorn heads, except for a single length of hair tied in a small ponytail. Descartes turned and waved his hands at the children, shooing them away.
Go home. It's almost time for your dinners, and your parents will be worried.
Almost reluctantly, the group of children dispersed into the streets.
Sorry about that. Strangers are still a novelty here.
Even with emissaries arriving? What?
Forget it. It's not my place.
Kane's point man's sense began to sound a faint alarm.
You said we could trust you.
Things have been changing here, as I said. Queen Nephron doesn't necessarily think keeping ourselves hidden for another century is the best tactic. But before we raise our profiles any higher, we need to know if we have allies out in the world.
What kind of allies are you talking about?
I can't say anymore, sorry.
Descartes continued to lead them through the winding streets. Over the years, the Aten citizens had tunneled into the valley walls, and openings gaped like dark mouths on either side of the canyon. Kane detected the smell of water on the air, and heard the low rumble of a swiftly moving river. They reached a dike built along a narrow concourse of rushing water. There they saw people filling buckets, Others were fishing, and several more were bathing. As Descartes led them deeper into the city, Kane noticed that there were schools, as well as small guard posts, shrines, and it seemed that every single home, from the smallest mud brick hut to the largest noble estate, had a garden. The gardens not only provided natural beauty, but food for the families as well. There were pens for livestock, mainly goats, and a few cows. They didn't see any idlers. Everyone seemed to be working. The outlanders received the impression that all of the adult citizens had a purpose, a function to fill. The number of artists was surprising. He saw men and women painting, creating sculptures, and carving wood into shapes resembling animals. The craftsmanship of all the items was beautiful, and it was clear that the artisans took great pride in their work. As they passed an open jeweler's stall, Kane saw a fine gold chain with a teardrop-shaped emerald nestled in a ring of gleaming silver. The emerald put him in mind of Bridget's eyes, and he thought of how nice it would look hanging from her neck. The vendor, a small, dark man in his 60s, noticed Kane's interest and held out the pendant toward him.
"I see you're thinking of a special woman who would look good wearing this."
"Am I that obvious?"
The vendor just smiled fatuously. Kane noticed Descartes grinning at him.
"What are you looking at?"
"She must be pretty special."
Kane gestured to the street ahead of them.
"Continue the tour."
Descartes headed toward the center of the valley and the massive Sphinx. 15-foot-tall walls surrounded the entire effigy. Men who were clearly sentries walked back and forth along the parapets, almost lazily, but they had their eyes on everyone and everything around them. A huge gate stood open at the front of the wall, and people passed in and out as they pleased. Sentries were posted at the entrance, and they stood in such extreme postures of attention, Kane would have mistaken them for statues if not for the rising and falling of their bare chests. Rising from the ground directly behind the guards loomed a statue carved out of a reddish stone. It depicted the likeness of a powerfully built man with incredibly broad shoulders and a massive chest. The figure wore the traditional kilt-like garb of the Aten citizenry, but atop his head was an elaborate headpiece sporting a rearing cobra. The figure's arms were crossed, one holding a scepter, the other what appeared to be a beaker. Even though the figure had been carved out of stone, there was no mistaking the godlike perfection of the features. They were identical to those of the Sphinx.
"Akhenaten, the royal father. Shortly after Nephron took control of the kingdom and relocated it into this valley, she had statues of her father erected in his memory. If she lets you tour the palace interior, you'll find hundreds of statues like this scattered around it."
Kane managed to tear his eyes off the massive stone figure and fix them on Descartes' face.
"Are you telling us that your current Queen Nephron is the daughter of the original Pharaoh of Aten?"
"She is."
"Then she'd be over a century old."
"She is."
"Her palace is inside the Sphinx?"
"It is."
Descartes continued on toward the Sphinx without another word. The three outlanders exchanged resigned glances and fell into step behind him. He followed a narrow gravel-covered path leading between the outstretched forelegs. The exterior of the colossal statue was almost perfectly smooth, showing once again an expert craftsmanship characteristic of Aten. A wide, square-cut doorway gaped open in the chest of the Sphinx. Descartes marched purposefully through it and into a wide, brightly lit passageway. The walls were covered in murals and hieroglyphs, depicting many different scenes. One sequence in particular drew the attention of Kane, Grant, and DeFore. The scenes showed a group of 7 people, 5 males and 2 females, one with long red hair of such flaming hue it seemed unnatural. They stood outside of what was unmistakably a representation of the redoubt in the desert. The next sequence of images showed the people being treated as prisoners and the flame-haired woman being brought before Akhenaten, his lust for her clearly, if exaggeratedly, indicated. Another collection of scenes showed the woman standing over the mutilated body of the pharaoh. She had apparently killed him with her own hands. The following scenes displayed a slender young woman with crimson eyes being crowned queen and then reading proclamations from a scroll. Another sequence depicted many men and women walking through the desert, carrying their meager belongings on their backs and shoulders, being led by the young queen. The images continued on, showing the construction of Aten.
"If you follow the entire wall, you'll see where it loops around to the history of ancient Egypt. Then back to the time of Skydark. It took me weeks to go through it all, since it sort of starts from the end.
Speaking of starting out from the end, can you tell us where we're going?
Descartes turned right and strode beneath a stone-lintled archway.
Here?
Grant, Defoe, and Kane came to an unsteady halt. The bathing chamber was brightly lit by large braziers filled with glowing coals and oil lamps attached to the walls. A huge square pool dominated the center of the room. Several statues of cherubic children holding jugs were stationed at each corner of the pool. A steady stream of fresh water flowed from the jugs into the pool, which drained slowly from a small grate in the center. Even though the water constantly drained away, the fresh water flowing from the statues always ensured that the pool's level was maintained. A number of thickly padded benches lined the walls around the pool, and a single table was set up near the only exit from the room. Like the passageway, the walls were covered in murals, depicting ancient waterways filled with bathers, as well as fishermen and people hunting crocodiles and hippopotami. Soothing music filtered into the room from hidden grates, and the air was smoky and fragrant as the braziers burned incense almost nonstop. A pair of lithe girls, naked except for a single string of beads around their slim waists, stood knee-deep in the water, holding large towels over their arms as they watched a young woman relaxing on her back in the center of the pool. She looked to be less than 20 years old, slim and graceful of build. When she stood, her glossy black hair fell to her hips, flowing evenly around her shoulders and back like a cloak. Beneath a small nose, her full lips were creased in a welcoming smile. Descartes strode to the edge of the pool and extended a hand to her. She waded over to him, completely at ease with her nudity. Her eyes flicked from Descartes to the three newcomers.
I'm back, Mavati. The emissaries were waiting for us, just as you and the other oracles foresaw.
You have done well, husband. I'll let Mother know negotiations can soon begin.
Kane finally managed to focus past the young woman's nakedness.
What do you mean, negotiations?
Mavati, I'm very impressed by the power of your oracles. Now all the offers can be put on the table.
Despite the acoustics of the bathing chamber, Kane instinctively recognized the subtle note of mockery in the voice. Stomach contracting in fear, he whirled and dropped into a crouch. His sin-eater slapped firmly into his palm. They froze at the sight of the tall woman with finely chiseled features, surrounded by a thick mane of hair so black it shone with blue highlights. Her violet eyes calmly swept over the three people, surveying Defoe first, then Kane, and finally settling on Grant.
Erica Van Sloan.
Descartes had led them into a trap after all. It took every last atom of Kane's willpower to restrain himself from firing his weapon at the violet-eyed woman.
Just stay where you are, Erica.
Erica Van Sloan smiled coldly at him, her eyes boring into his skull. She looked considerably different from the last time Kane had seen her. Then she had been rigged out in the revealing, gauzy ceremonial robes of a Shakti priestess. Now she had four imperial troopers with her, all wearing midnight blue boots, helmets, and coveralls with facings of bright scarlet. The faces under the overhangs of the helmets were of an Asian cast. They carried compact SIG AMT subguns.
I don't plan on going anywhere. I was here first.
Put the blasters down. She's not here to fight with you.
The barrels of Grant's and Kane's sin-eaters didn't waver.
That would be a first. Just why is she here?
Put the blasters down. She's a guest, just like you are.
Have her soldiers lower their weapons and we'll do the same.
Erica nodded very slightly, and the four men lowered the subguns, letting the bores point to the floor. Only then did Kane and Grant holster their own sidearms.
What are you doing here, Erica?
Erica's smile widened.
I could ask you the same question, Kane. Where is your usual complement of troublemakers? Mohandas, Bridget, and that little albino bitch.
They'll be along directly. Answer Kane's question.
From the pool, Mavati spoke up.
She is here to open negotiations with the city and Queen Nephron.
Negotiations for what?
Mavati walked toward the edge of the pool, her arms held out to the sides, water dripping from her supple limbs. The two girls began to dry her off with towels.
To join the Imperator's new order.
Why the hell would you want to do that? Descartes, don't you know who this is?
I've been told, and I know of the history you and your group have with her.
An alliance with Sam would allow the people of this kingdom to come out of hiding for the first time in over a century. Far too long have they lived in fear of coming to the attention of the barons.
Almost completely dry, Mavati left the pool and walked over to Descartes, who held out a robe for her to slip on. Taking him by the arm, she led him to the bench. Descartes stared at her in adoration. One of the handmaidens handed her a solid gold, gem-encrusted cup.
So far, the Imperator's emissary hasn't convinced either myself or the Queen of the benefits of such an alliance.
She's more than the Imperator's emissary. She's his mom.
Mavati smiled over the rim of the cup.
We know. She didn't tell us that, but we know.
Erica Van Sloan folded her arms over her ample breasts.
And my son knows about the powers that you, your mother, and many of the citizens inside this city possess. Sam shares similar abilities.
And so you believe that because we might share a few psychic talents, that is enough for us to want to join forces with him?
Would that be such a bad thing? Look at what you've accomplished here. You have peace, prosperity, no one goes without, no one fears starvation or crime. You have created the blueprint for a new order in the Outlands. No longer would your people live in fear of the barons or the roamers. With Sam's help, in a matter of a few years, we could reshape the nation and then bring the Aten model of society to the rest of the world.
You tried the same thing only a couple of months back with your Scorpia Prime scam, using the natives of Assam as patsies. You're pulling the same con on the people here.
We offer the people of Aten the chance to live free, without having to stay hidden any longer.
Free? They're free now, not answering to the demands of any of the barons. They don't need you or your mutant son.
All the while, Descartes sat beside Mavati, listening quietly to the exchange between the two people. Erica clenched her fists, then relaxed, forcing a smile to her face.
There's no point in discussing things any further until the Queen is here.
For once, we actually agree on something.
Suddenly, Mavati and Descartes rose to their feet, squaring their shoulders and stiffening their spines. They stared at the entrance to the chamber.
The Queen is here. All of you must pay her homage.
Kane's head swiveled to follow Descartes' and Mavati's gaze. A second later, a retinue of animal-helmeted incarnates marched into the hall, all of them holding metal rods across their bare chests. They took a position on either side of the doorway in a crescent formation. A woman strode through the entrance and paused, striking a pose with her right hand on her hip, her slim body gleaming like polished bronze. There was no doubt in Kane's mind, she was Queen Nefron. Descartes instantly dropped to one knee, bowing his head. Erica Van Sloan and her guards followed suit. For a moment, Kane's rebellious nature kept him on his feet, but a sense of diplomacy, which had lately developed within him, told him to kneel, although, due to the sharp senses of a point man, he didn't take his eyes off the woman as the others around him had. Defoe and Grant followed his example. Kane gazed up at her with a frank appraisal. Dressed in a white silken gown, with a neckline that plunged between her firm breasts and cut high on the right side, Nefron's warm bronze skin seemed to glow in the lamplight. She was shorter than Mavati in her black-laced sandals, but she held herself with a regal dignity that easily dominated the entire room. Kane admired the beautiful structure of bones beneath the sun-bronzed flesh of her face. That face looked very young, no doubt due to costly and time-consuming cosmetic care, but certainly not even close to half a century old, much less a full 100 years. The resemblance to Mavati was so strong that two women might have been twin sisters of the same age, rather than mother and daughter. Painted on her forehead in what appeared to be gold leaf was a winged disc sun symbol. Nefren's sweeping eyelashes were cold and shining, framed by a mass of black hair, coiffed, upswept, and glittering with what appeared to be diamonds and silver threaded among the locks. Jewels and gold glittered at her throat, her wrists, and her ankles. Nefren's gaze met Kane's, and he barely managed to keep the shock from registering on his face. There were no whites to her eyes, only irises of blood red with hugely expanded pupils that seemed to reflect only shadows. Nefren's eyes slid away from Kane, and she gestured imperiously to Descartes.
Stand, young prince.
The young man stood, but kept his eyes lowered.
Yes, my queen.
Kane felt his eyebrows rise as Nefren referred to the young man as a prince, but he said nothing.
I see you brought the Outlanders into the city. You have done well.
Thank you, my queen. But there was an incident. One the oracles did not foresee.
Tell me.
A Bastion and a Herusian arrived at your father's birthplace. There was a struggle. The Bastion was slain. But so was Apis.
Nefren's expression of detached calm didn't alter.
I understand. And the bodies?
I returned with them to Aten.
Nefra nodded as if the matter were now closed, and her crimson orbs settled on Cain. He felt an involuntary shudder slip up and down his spine, but he had encountered telepathy and mind touch before, and he wasn't afraid of them.
You and your friends may rise, Cain.
Cain, Grant, and DeFore did as she said.
You have many questions.
Cain took a half step forward.
First of all, we want to know if you might have some of the medical equipment from the redoubt.
What else?
We also need some tools, and maybe some electronic parts to repair the door to the redoubt, so we can use the gateway to return home. If you don't have that, would you be willing to allow us access to your communication gear, so we can let our home base know that we're okay?
Cain felt very uncomfortable making the requests. Nefren studied him silently with those solid, blood-red eyes, and Cain resisted the urge to avert his gaze. He stood perfectly still, not looking away. At length, a small smile appeared on the queen's full lips.
At this time, I am willing to grant one of your three requests.
Cain stood, waiting for her to say more. He didn't wait long.
I have just come from my oracles. They tell me there is no need for you to use our communication equipment to inform your friends of your status. Nor is there any need to repair the door of the installation. Your companions arrived there a short time ago and are being escorted to the city even as we speak.
What companions?
I do not know their names. Two women and a man. That is all I know.
Do you have the medical equipment?
We do. But there is much to discuss regarding its disposition. I am not willing to let it go without an agreement that will benefit both parties.
Like what?
A possible alliance between your people and my city.
Nefren looked away from Cain and glanced down at Erica.
Which would possibly involve the Imperator.
To hell with that. We'll get what we need elsewhere, then. If you knew the kind of creature the Imperator is...
I am aware of the bad blood between you and the Imperator's faction. But I am also aware you cannot make unilateral decisions for the faction you represent. You should wait until your companions arrive, lest you make a rash decision independently.
Cain saw the superior smirk crossing Erica Van Sloan's face, and he fought down the urge to unleather his weapon and kill the conniving bitch on the spot. He said nothing, but his jaw muscles knotted as he clenched his teeth in frustrated fury.
Is that really too much to ask? You could gain much from an agreement, the least of which is a method to save what could very well be your child.
Cain's rage mounted as his sense of disorientation grew. The Queen, Erica Van Sloan, Descartes, everyone in the city of Aten seemed to have the advantage over him and his friends. He felt shame as well that he had been duped, lured into the city. But he wasn't quite sure how it all happened and who was the real culprit.
I can see in your heart you would not want any harm to come to the babe or to the mother, Quavel. You can't hide the truth from me.
If that's the case, you know I won't make any deals with Van Sloan. I'm willing to cut a deal with you, but no way in hell will Cerberus bargain with her.
Erica climbed to her feet.
Don't be so fast to make those decisions, Cain. Once you've heard our proposal, you might very well change your mind.
Yeah, and on that day, Baron Kobold will embrace me like a brother.
Once your companions arrive, we will begin the negotiations in earnest. I am willing to give you access to the material you need, but first you must hear out the Imperial Mother. If, when she is finished, you still won't agree to the bargaining terms, you and your friends will be expected to leave.
With that, Nefren turned and marched with a lithe grace out of the bathing chamber, followed by the Incarnates. As soon as Nefren and the Incarnates were gone, Cain whirled on Descartes, barely able to restrain himself from grabbing the youth by the throat.
What the hell is going on here? What have you gotten us into, you little son of a bitch?
Do not speak to my husband so disrespectfully.
Feeling awkward, and more confused than ever, Kane exchanged questioning glances with DeFore and Grant, who could only shrug or shake their heads in commiseration.
You knew we were coming here.
Yes, and my husband told me all about you.
Whatever you've heard, it's probably blown totally out of proportion.
Mavadi placed her arm around Descartes' shoulders and leaned her head against his.
I know that if you hadn't destroyed the Mesa facility, I might not have met him.
The Outlands people have heard of you and your friends. They know the Barons are not as all-powerful as they had been conditioned to believe. There is a new rallying cry echoing across the Outlands, and your names are at the forefront of that cry.
It's a little late to try to swing us to your side, Erica. Your bitch, Baron Beausoleil, tortured me with an infrasound wand not too long ago. You might have forgotten that, but I haven't.
I'm not trying to recruit you. I'm simply stating a fact. But without the support of Sam, your insurrectionist work against the Barons is doomed to failure.
I think you're forgetting that Sam tops our list of targets.
The tall, violet-eyed woman shook her head.
You are such fools. Sam will rule with compassion. He has no desire to see the people of the world suffer any longer. There is no need for the humans and hybrids to live apart, and Sam will ensure that with your help and others who are drawn to our cause, that a new age will be ushered in.
Oh, for the love of...
Sam was born to unite the nine baronies under his leadership and eventually unite the world. In the end, we will answer to the Imperator and the Imperator alone.
Countless despots and dictators have said those exact same words throughout history. My own grandfather, for one.
Perhaps. But unlike them, Sam is not ruled by his own thirst for power. He follows the great plan.
Mavati's eyes burned hotly as she gazed intently at Erica Van Sloan.
So you said when you arrived. But no matter what you say, power breeds only a thirst for more power.
Exactly. He'd want to add your city to his list of holdings.
Would it help our position to strike a treaty that would keep your kingdom safe for all time? We have no interest in annexing Aten, unlike the Baronese, who would only absorb it into their territories and enslave your people.
Erica gestured to Kane, DeFore, and Grant.
They can offer you nothing except to involve you in bloodshed and struggles with Barons that would put Aten at the risk of being discovered.
And you wouldn't? You already brought Sam's forces here.
Enough of this. All proposals will be given serious and due consideration, but in the council chambers, not here.
As you wish. I'll be in my chambers until I am summoned.
Her tone of voice was so calculatedly contrite, so unctuous, Kane could barely control his gag reflex. Gesturing imperiously to her soldiers, she left the chamber.
Mavati, why does your mother listen to her? Even I can tell she's not to be trusted. And I don't have psi abilities.
You can't deny she has a sharp mind, and her proposals are quite intriguing.
Neither you nor your mother seem too worried about the Imperator.
Why should we be? Until the oracles say otherwise, we have no reason to fear her or her son.
Don't trust her. Don't believe her.
My mother doesn't trust anyone from the outside until they prove themselves. I don't trust anyone whose mind the oracles can't sense. Never fear. Once we have discovered her true intentions, then the Queen will make a final decision.
Who the hell are the oracles?
Instead of answering the question, Descartes stepped forward, hooking a thumb toward the doorway.
Come on. I'll take you to your quarters so you can get something to eat and wait for your friends to get here.
Reluctantly, Kane, Grant, and DeFore followed the young man out of the bathing chamber and into the passageway. Once they were in the corridor, Descartes spoke softly.
Sorry, I didn't know you had such a history with Van Sloan. I should have warned you.
There are a lot of things you should have done, son. Not rigging the redoubt door controls is the least of them.
Clamping his mouth shut, Descartes didn't reply, which told Kane his guess was dead on target. He continued walking along the corridor, not bothering to see if the three Outlanders followed him or not. Grant muttered darkly to no one in particular.
Why does this shit always have to happen to us?